Hi, and welcome along. I'm Joe Augustine, and this is Radio Finance, a brand new podcast from The Asian Banker. Now, what makes this podcast special is that we're going to be talking about some pretty deep stuff, but from the perspective of the man in the street. That's where I come in. As someone who doesn't know a whole lot about the world of finance, I've got my questions. And each episode, we tackle one aspect of finance. On today's show, philanthropy. Not only a word that's hard to spell, it's hard to say. And there's a whole lot more to it than just giving away your money. To guide me on my journey to understand how the wealthy use their wealth to help others, The Asian Banker has arranged to have two experts join me on the show.
I'm Eugenia Koh from Standard Chartered. I oversee the sustainable investing proposition for the private bank and wealth management globally.
I'm Ruth Shapiro. I'm the chief executive of the Center for Asian Philanthropy and Society, CAPS. We are a research and advisory nonprofit organization based in Hong Kong, but working throughout Asia.
Now, Ruth, could you tell us a bit more about the mission of your organization?
Our mission is to increase both the quality and the quantity of all kinds of private resources that go toward doing good in Asia.
And how exactly do you achieve that? What do you do?
So we do research on philanthropy, on CSR, on impact investing, on social impact bonds. In effect, all the ways that private money is channeled toward doing good.
And why exactly Asia?
We think that there is an opportunity to unleash a lot more capital in this region, and our goal is to do the kind of research that leads to system change to allow that to happen.
Ruth Shapiro, Chief Executive at CAPS. Now, Eugenia, you're at Standard Chartered. From the bank's perspective, this whole thing about philanthropy and helping clients with their philanthropy, isn't this quite a new thing?
It's something that's taken place more over the last couple of years, not just in terms of philanthropy. So philanthropy has been around for a long time. And I think, you know, in Asian culture, the act of giving back is actually embedded in many of the Confucian cultures out there. But the move also towards complementing philanthropy with sustainable investing, which is what I look at, that is perhaps a more recent phenomenon. As investors and as philanthropists look at complementing the act of giving and grant making with looking at some impact investments or sustainable investments.
Now, Eugenia, you mentioned about how philanthropy has been, you know, embedded into our Asian culture. So it's been around for a long time. Ruth, I'm just curious, is your organization started up in Asia? How did you figure out what you had to do?
Our first big project was to do 30 case studies of really good local nonprofit organizations and social enterprises throughout the region and interview 50 high net worth and ultra high net worth individuals. And that study resulted in a book called Pragmatic Philanthropy, which is free and can be downloaded from our site or Amazon. And it was also used to help us to figure out what kind of programs and projects we were going to do first.
So what was the most important thing you found out?
We had quite a few findings, but one of the important findings to understand about Asia is that there's a really serious trust deficit. When we interviewed those wealthy people, whether they were in Korea, Indonesia, India, wherever they were in Asia, without exception, they all said, I would give more locally if I trusted the local nonprofit organizations to receive that funding, and I do not.
Well, what about other differences in the Asian approach to philanthropy?
In terms of the government, Asian philanthropists and business leaders want to give aligned with their government, not in contradiction to their government, which is a pretty different view than many Western donors. Asian philanthropists are business people, and they want to give in ways that promote education, healthcare, poverty alleviation, environment, many of the same social challenges that the government also cares about.
So it sounds like there are lots of choices. You know, let's say someone's very successful and wants to give back to society and they want to start up on their philanthropic journey. How would your bank, Eugenia, engage with someone like this?
It really starts with a conversation about what that individual philanthropist or investor is passionate about. I think what you commonly hear among many who are starting out to think about giving or have been doing it for some time is that, you know, I'm keen on donating maybe a certain amount of money to building hospitals and to building schools. But we try to probe it a bit more to say, even within that, actually, what is it that you're truly passionate about? What is it that you want to solve for? So we have, this structured way of helping them through their thought process. We call it our impact philosophy, which is underpinned by the theory of change methodology. Essentially, you know, looking at a series of questions that prompts you to think a bit more deeply about what you're looking to solve for and how you can contribute towards that. And that's where I think the portfolio approach comes in, because there are some areas that you would definitely for sure need philanthropic capital to reach the communities or the sectors that you're passionate about. And in other ways, for instance, in healthcare or education, it could be grant money in the poorest of the poor communities, but at a higher level where, you know, you're looking at the lower income groups who can perhaps afford to pay, but currently not in the form in which services are being delivered. It is a consideration of perhaps investing in some of these impact businesses that can then help ensure that, you know, the impact is a bit more exponential and that it's sustainable over a longer period of time.
So let's say you've had this conversation, and in your experience, you know, as people decide to embark on a certain project, what are the reasons they do that?
I think there are a range of reasons, but at the heart of it, you know, there is always an interest in a particular sector. So, I mean, they could do good either because they're passionate or, you know, from a CSR perspective, sometimes it is good business sense as well to be looking at that. For others, you know, their families in which they see that their children, their next gen, are passionate about giving back, and to better connect with their children, they want to also be involved in saying, how can we look at joint projects together? So I think while the motivations could be multifaceted, but yet, you know, The crystallization of that intent, you know, the sectors which they're passionate about, collectively, all of that remains no matter what your motivations are. And for us, what's important is to help in crystallizing that and to unlock capital to go into the areas which I think, you know, these investors are most interested in and which then can help solve some of these larger issues and problems in the world.
Ruth, has your experience been the same?
You know, when you have money to give, there you have many choices about what to give to. And wealthy people are asked all the time to give. So part of their motivation, and Eugenia is absolutely right, maybe they've dealt with cancer in their lives, or maybe they've received a scholarship, or something happened to them to make them particularly interested in one form of giving or one type of project. But what we found is that if you have choice, many of the older generation give in ways that also increase or enhance relationships that they care about. So it's, we're operating across Asia, so it's the Guanxi element. So if you're going to give, you want to have impact, sure, but if you can also enhance relationships that you care about, all the more better. And those include relationships with government. I've spent my whole career in Asia, but I'm an American. And I thought when I went around and told philanthropists, well, you know, your return on investment is often enhanced guanxi or, you know, enhanced relationships, they might say no. And in fact, all of them say, absolutely. What you give to, who you're giving alongside, the type of investment you make historically in Asia has a lot to do with the relationships that you care about or want to garner.
And how is that different from the new generation?
The next gen, the younger gen now, that many of whom have been educated elsewhere, are coming back with more of an impact focus, less about relationships and more about making a difference, often using a business model.
Is this what you're seeing a lot of now at Standard Chartered?
Definitely. I think, you know, especially with the new generation or the next gen, a lot of current kind of investors or givers are looking for efficiency of their giving. There is a term around strategic philanthropy, around impact investing, which essentially is about getting back a measurable return as well. So, you know, it's not just about giving for the sake of giving, but really seeing what outcomes you can be driving. And I think that's why in this space of sustainable and impact investing, the discussions around, you know, having impact measurement reports is increasingly important, because people want to know what outcomes are being achieved. And, you know, I think it links back to Ruth's point around building trust and that whole transparency of the giving dollar, which is increasingly important. I think it is possible. I mean, you know, in some instances of impact investments that you make, you may require to trade off some of your returns for enhanced impact, or you might need very patient capital. So essentially, you know, putting money into those enterprises that would take multiple years to get back some form of a return in terms of a financial return. But there are other impact investments which could deliver you returns which are quite decent, you know, and they're based on innovative business models that look at solving for some of these problems using a very entrepreneurial mindset. So some of the examples could be these healthcare hospitals in India, which provide, you know, let's say eye surgery for a fraction of the cost of what you can get out in the market, you know, $35 compared to $2,000. And they do it with a high efficiency, high productivity model. And they're reaching communities who can afford to pay $35, but not $2,000. And, you know, charging them for it. And in so doing, they're able to grow at a scalable manner. And the investors that invest into it then help also provide for eye care and access to healthcare across many of these villages.
Now, of course, that sounds like the perfect example for me of how wealth is being used in society to create some good and at the same time make some money. But when it comes to business models, you know, for philanthropy, there must be quite a variance in terms of what you can expect.
There's a lot of confusion around returns. The types of returns that you can get by investing, impact investing into social enterprises vary considerably. Some people want market returns, and you have some very big funds out there saying that their impact funds do deliver market or better returns. Some use that term patient capital, which Eugenia mentioned, saying, I really care about the social impact more than the financial return. So I think what I'm sure StandChart, as well as other banks, are doing with their clients and what we do with our advisory is to essentially probe what kind of return are you mostly looking for. Are you looking for doing good and doing well, or are you willing to kind of take a lower return in order to have bigger social impact? So those are questions that are being discussed all over, not just Asia, but the world, and are getting more and sophisticated as this area of impact investing grows. But before I turn it over, let me just mention, in our study where we analyzed the factors that most contribute to successful and vibrant social enterprise ecosystems, we found that the overwhelming majority of social enterprises rely on philanthropy at the early stages of their being. And it makes a lot of sense, because when you're a venture capitalist betting on the next Facebook, you bet on that, you take a big risk because you want a big return. Social enterprises are not going to give you those big returns. And so the type of capital that's available in the very early stages, in the angel stages, tends to be either philanthropy or government grants. Capital that is looking for return comes in later.
So it sounds like there's several kinds of philanthropic investors. How do you make sure that, you know, they're happy with their investments?
I think a very big part of it is really around expectation management. So we ran a survey as well of investors across the region, and we looked at, you know, the Sustainable Development Goals, their interest in some of these goals, and we probed as well the metrics that they would care most about and also expectations around these metrics. And I think it was really interesting when it came to looking at that expectation piece, because we saw that a big group of respondents who were going to be putting money into some of these investments expected to see at least a 30% progress in 3 to 5 years. And we know that that is not necessarily always realistic. So a lot of it is also ensuring that even as this grows as a concept and an area of interest, that we're able to have really nuanced and honest conversations around both the financial and impact returns, the outcomes and the expectations. Otherwise, it would be really difficult for investors, I think, to get comfortable with it. The way we look at it also is that we advise folks who are thinking about it to kind of start small, you know. I mean, it's not going to necessarily be a very big part of the portfolio at the moment. And I think, you know, it's important to get comfortable with it, to experiment before they think about going deeper and further.
As you talk about these investors, it sounds like you're talking about people, you know, who take their time to think about exactly what it is that they want to invest in. Is there a rise in the number of people who, let's say, get moved, you know, suddenly, and they say, you know what, I have to do something now, and they come to you and say, look, listen, give me something, help me find something quickly?
Yeah, I mean, I think those numbers are still small but growing. Actually, the interest that we see is across two groups. One, you know, really the next gen, right? They are saying that, look, you know, we really want to do something, and we're looking at our family portfolios, and we do want to make it a bit more sustainable. We want to see how we can drive a bit more impact, be it in the philanthropic work or in even the investment pot. On the other hand, you know, you have these ultra high net worth individuals, high net worth individuals who are starting to think about legacy planning. And, you know, as they pass on their wealth, as they pass on their businesses, they're starting to think about the impact that they want to leave on the world. And I think the concept around sustainable businesses that can drive both a social as well as a financial impact, that resonates with a lot of entrepreneurs, you know. And in Asia, if you look at Asia's wealth, a lot of wealth is created through entrepreneurship. So people kind of understand it. So there is a group that understands it and say, hey, you know, I'm thinking of how I can be further involved.
Now, in your surveys of your customers, you know, what stops them from engaging in philanthropic activities? I mean, money aside.
There were things such as, you know, the question around returns, that was a big one. The question around kind of transparency and the availability of information, and also, you know, just understanding the different products and solutions out there. So I think that we are still in a phase of really educating clients, educating, you know, even our bankers on some of the propositions that are out there. And, you know, it's a whole space, right, within sustainable investing. You have impact investing, which is really focused on direct kind of outcomes. And then you also have concepts such as ESG investing, which is looking at just buying into, you know, big corporates which are being run sustainably. And so I think with a lot of terminology as well, it's quite a bit for investors to get their heads around, which is why we're very focused on educating them alongside the journey.
So it seems like I'm not the only one who has a little something to learn about philanthropy. Now, just wondering, you know, what are the trends as far as giving goes?
I think there's some trends that are coming together that are interesting to note. First of all, I think around the world, there are increased societal expectations that wealthy will engage and give back. There is the motivation from some people saying, hey, I want to do this. But there's also, just as likely, it's somebody saying, I'm being asked to do this. I need to show the community that I care about the community. This is, I think, being driven by a couple of factors. One, I think there is a notion, and I would argue it emanates really from Silicon Valley, that when you become wealthy, you should give back. That is the norm there, and I think that's really spreading. Maybe it's older than that, the notion of noblesse oblige in Europe, way before Silicon Valley. But in any case, there is this kind of growing societal expectations. At the same time, you have the wealthy realizing that the income disparity in the world is not sustainable, and that they need to do something to address this current situation, which is playing out politically and economically all over the world. What do the wealthy need to do in order to essentially continue to have license to operate? And more of them are realizing they need to be seen as engaged and committed citizens and be providing those kind of benefits to the people in the communities in which they're operating.
Isn't there also a shift that's happening in terms of how people are raising funds now for special causes?
On the complete opposite side of the spectrum, you have this growing phenomenon of crowdfunding, which is increasing exponentially throughout Asia. And that's when, you know, someone can just give $2 or $3 through their phone. And certain organizations have really capitalized on this and are doing a lot to raise funds through crowdfunding. And that's only going to continue. So that's really much more grassroots. So I think from the top down, you have a recognition that income disparity is increasing and it may not be good for them, that there's societal expectations on behavior. And from the bottom up, you have this increasing use of technology to allow crowdfunding, all of which points to more engagement toward doing good.
Is it all about doing good?
I think what motivates is also not just doing good, but doing well, right? You know, to the extent that it makes good business sense for them to be involved in doing good, that's also another lens to it. So with some of the big macro trends or, you know, the big thematics that are coming up around water and sanitation, around education, around healthcare, actually there are opportunities for investments which look to drive capital into some of these big kind of thematics while doing good. So I think that's a very practical aspect of it. The other area is really risk management. You know, sometimes we see that people are investing in some of these sustainable funds, you know, with doing good as a secondary motivation, but really looking at it from a risk perspective. You know, if you're investing in companies that are riding on some of these trends or that are just being better managed or are considering the environmental and social factors, in the mid to long term, they will be the companies of the future. It's also pragmatism, I think, you know, that drives some of this.
Now, since we seem to have some idea about what drives it, couldn't we just pull harder on these levers that cause, you know, this sort of investment in philanthropy?
Well, I'm glad you asked this question, Joe, and because it's exactly the reason we do a study which comes out every 2 years called the Doing Good Index. The first year we did it, it was released in January of last year, and the next one will be released after Chinese New Year in February 2020, and we work in 18 economies, so 16 countries plus Hong Kong and Taiwan, to really understand what are the factors that either enable or impede the giving and receiving of money, whatever kind of money that is, philanthropy, CSR, impact investing. And what we found is, and let me just say, there are four main categories of questions that we look at. Three of them have to do with government. So regulations, tax and fiscal policies, and procurement policies have to do with government. And the fourth category is what we call ecosystem, which is really what people and companies are, how much do they embrace giving back? And what we found is that government has a really important role to play, but in every economy we studied, the ecosystem section was scored higher, which means that people are out doing interesting things. Companies are out, in effect, despite government, not because of government. And that if government could put in place the right policies, the right regulations, the right incentives, people and companies would do a lot more. And what do those look like? We think taxes matter and tax subsidies matter. When Singapore decided to provide a 250% tax subsidy for both individuals and corporations to give philanthropically, the amount of giving went up. which is not surprising, not only because it's real money, although the taxes in Singapore are low, it's also messaging from the government that the government is encouraging people to engage in this way. So the Doing Good Index points to very specific policies and regulations that governments can do to increase accountability, increase transparency, and align incentives so that more money, more capital is essentially flowing into the system.
Now, it's easy to contemplate philanthropy, especially when times are good, when there's excess. But, you know, people are talking about the market conditions being quite challenging as we speak, and perhaps even getting worse as we look down the road. What can well-meaning philanthropists do to make sure that their plans to do good are sustainable through these possible tough times?
It's something that, you know, those who are really very passionate about philanthropy and, you know, understand the impact of the giving, they look at it in a couple of ways. I think, you know, we are seeing people set up foundations or look at setting up portfolios, which then can ensure that sustainability of that giving, even amidst bad times. So we were speaking with an individual who, you know, they run a big corporate, a big family business in one of our markets and very passionate about supporting orphans, right? And every year they commit 10% of their profits or their income to the support of these orphans. And thousands of orphans rely on some of the grants that they give, either for education, for scholarships, so on and so forth. And I think, you know, even as they acknowledge that it might go into a more challenging environment and they don't want their giving to be overly impacted, the business cycles, they have decided then to look at starting either a foundation or to carve out that money to be putting into portfolios that then can give out the regular dividends to the causes that they support.
As a nonprofit organization and the head of one that raises every penny, I just hope that there's no downturn that affects our fundraising. I hope it doesn't pan out that those are linked, but we'll see.
Now, every now and then we'll hear about a huge anonymous donation that's being made. But I imagine that there must be also some anonymous donations that are made that just don't get reported about. Do we actually know how much money goes into philanthropy?
It's absolutely impossible to know. And anybody who tells you that they can somehow come up with a number per country, moving below the radar screen, through the Cayman Islands, through other means. And so, yeah, I think you're absolutely right. There's a lot of giving that is happening essentially anonymously. And we cannot know how much it is, but we can get a sense that it's happening.
What about from your perspective, Eugenia? Do more of your clients like to give publicly or anonymously?
I mean, we see quite a mix. I mean, there are clients that want to be very private in that giving, so definitely there is quite a bit of that going on. And, you know, it plays to some cultures, you know, in some of the Asian cultures, they tend not to want to make too big of a deal out of it. So it's really a whole spectrum.
Now, one of the things that people do talk about when it comes to ultra high net worth individuals, I mean, we're talking about the billionaires of the world. The question that is sometimes asked is, how much money do you really need? You know, I mean, why not just give it all away?
Well, I mean, Mark Zuckerberg and Priscilla Chan said that they're going to give 99% of their money away, which still left them with, I think, 800 million. Seems like enough. So I think that that's happening, that there's more and more the ultra high net worth that are signing the giving pledge. And there is a sense that we can give a lot away and still lead comfortable lives. Our chairman tends to say that he doesn't want his kids to inherit a ton of money because they may not work as hard. So there's a debate about that among families that I'm sure Eugenia is involved with some of those discussions as well. That conversation is happening and it's really a personal choice.
Yeah, I mean, it's really a mix. I mean, we have been seeing some of the trends in terms of giving. And as Ruth mentioned, with Bill Gates and the Giving Pledge, that has gotten some momentum globally. At the end of the day, it's a very personal choice. I think it's important to not prescribe one way or another. I mean, giving is also quite personal. I think what matters is that overall, you know, the amount of giving and the amount of capital that's being channeled into some of these causes and issues continues to grow year on year, and that everyone across the ecosystem really builds that up.
Now, I understand that at Standard Chartered, you're engaging the next generation. Could you tell us a bit more about how you do that?
We run our next gen program that we call our Future Global Leaders Program, which is focused on the sons and daughters of ultra wealthy clients. There are five pillars to it: sustainability, philanthropy, leadership, communications, entrepreneurship. And every time we have those discussions, we do see the passion in the room, you know, people thinking about how they can be good stewards of the wealth, what that means, how much do they really decide to kind of give to causes. You know, as part of the program, when we were at Davos this year with the Next Gen Group, they were part of a session which Bill Gates hosted, and he talked about his own philanthropic giving. And all of that inspires, I think, people to think a bit more deeply about it. So, you know, I think some of that thinking and some of those discussions are taking place. But I think it's really important not to be prescriptive about it.
Now, as more and more wealth seems to be heading towards the individuals, are we going to get to a point where we're going to see a shift in power in terms of, you know, social causes and stuff like that, where it moves from the government leading that kind of charge to the wealthy individual?
Well, Joe, you have to realize that no matter how much philanthropy there is, it's a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of what governments spend on things like education and healthcare. The role of philanthropy is absolutely not to replace government. The role of philanthropy is to take risk capital to go the last mile where government somehow can't reach, or to do innovative projects that somehow government can pick up and learn from, or to fill the gaps, but they cannot replace government. I would argue should not replace government. And when you're talking about billions versus trillions, it really can't replace government.
Yeah, I think you'll find that when you speak to a lot of global philanthropists, they always take a partnership approach with the government. It's never one or the other. And the two would come together to complement a lot of the work that needs to take place.
Now, consider the following two statements, and you tell me which one you think is true. The future is bright and we're trying to make it happen, or the future is bleak and we're trying to prevent it from happening.
So I'm a natural optimist. So for me, I think the future is bright. I mean, obviously, there's a lot more that we can and must do. But if you think about the progress that has been made, I think sometimes we don't celebrate enough the progress, right? Significant progress have been made towards eradicating polio. I think now just a couple of cases, which, you know, we can soon be eradicating it, you know, malaria as well. So a lot has been done, you know. Obviously, there's a lot more that we can and must be doing, but we must not forget the progress that has been achieved and what it has gotten us to get to this point and all the efforts that are currently being channeled to bring it even further.
And Ruth, what about yourself?
So we focus on Asia. And what I would say is in this part of the world, it's a very dynamic part of the world. Change is happening rapidly. There's a lot of wealth being created. And we are just at the beginning of putting that toward good use. And I think that, as we've discussed throughout, there's more and more of an appetite to use money toward win-win strategies and, in effect, do good. I think that both Eugenia and I could not be in this business if we didn't think optimistically and think that there's a real opportunity to make the world a better place and that we want to help be part of that.
And on that optimistic note, we'll end off this very first edition of Radio Finance, the brand new podcast from the Asian Banker, designed to help people like you and I understand a little bit more about the world of finance. I hope you enjoyed your journey into the world of philanthropy today and found out more about how the wealthy are doing good in the world. If you have comments or suggestions about the podcast, please let us know. And I look forward to talking to you again on the next edition of Radio Finance. Thanks for listening.